I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, an honest conversation with an abortion doctor. She says, yes, some women have regrets, and doctors rarely but do make mistakes. Still, abortion must remain legal and safe. First, the news. The Cold War is over, so said Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to reporters traveling with her today after she and her Polish counterpart signed a deal in Warsaw to station parts of the U.S. missile defense shield in Poland. But is the Cold War over or reigniting? Russia is furious that missiles will be stationed in its former satellite, even though Rice insisted that the U.S. sees rogue states such as Iran or North Korea as the primary threat.
Missile defense, of course, is aimed at no one. It is in our defense that we do this.
But, of course, today's signing comes after a week in which Russia invaded Georgia to protect breakaway regions that Georgia claims but Russia believes want to stay in the Russian orbit. Julian Barnes is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And, Julian, it's widely understood that that move last week by Russia pushed Poland into this agreement, which had been in a stalemate. But did the looming missile agreement with the U.S. and Poland also push Russia into Georgia?
Well, I think that the background of Russia asserting itself in Georgia is the expansion of NATO, is this missile defense in Europe. This wasn't a triggering event for Georgia, but it is part of the context and the background that's going on, and part of the things that Russia is annoyed about with the West.
Well, and Secretary Rice was in Brussels yesterday for an emergency meeting of NATO. Georgia wants to be a member. Poland is a member. Of course, Russia isn't. So how does today's news, you know, muddy those NATO waters?
Well, it firmly plants the United States in protecting Poland, which is the U.S., the NATO treaty obligation. But it also sort of complicates the Georgia situation. Eastern European states like Poland say the recent events show why we need to expand NATO to Ukraine, to Georgia, to the other former Soviet states. Western Europe is not so sure about what we should do and whether that would annoy Russia further. So we're going to have to see this play out over the next few months.
Well, to the agreement that was signed today for the missile shield in Poland, it's part of an American system. Tell us more about that system, and what is the thinking that it will work?
Well, initial tests of the system weren't very successful. There are interceptors in Alaska, and there are some other interceptors and other radar in California and other states. But the most recent tests have intercepted missiles. But what is important to remember is the tests have been on very simple intercontinental ballistic missiles, the kind of thing that North Korea would potentially fire. There's no sense that it would work to stop a much more sophisticated missile like the kind Russia has.
Well, and that brings us to the question, will this system be built? The New York Times reported today that last spring the House Armed Services Committee voted to withhold money until the system could be certified reliable. And the presidential candidates are split here in the U.S. John McCain is for the shield. Barack Obama says the system is unproven. So is it a done deal?
I don't think it's a completely done deal. I think that it is very likely that a rudimentary system will continue to develop, but it will take billions more to make it stop sophisticated missiles, and that's much more in doubt whether we will ever go that far.
Well, meanwhile, Poland has agreed to have the missiles in its backyard if the system is ever built. But the U.S. also agreed to equip Poland with Patriot missiles as a defense against a short-term attack. Do we assume that means Russia? And how useful will those Patriot missiles be against Russia's huge armament?
This is something that was very important to some politicians within Poland to get this Patriot battery. The U.S. was, prior to the Georgia military action, resisting. We didn't want to put those batteries in Poland because we thought they would be too provocative. That does further complicate the U.S.-Russia relationship.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're still waiting for those vice presidential picks, and the issue of abortion has made its way into the conversation. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham raised the possibility that John McCain could pick a running mate who favors abortion rights. Talk show host Rush Limbaugh's response, if McCain does, it's not going to be pretty. Well, a CNN analyst speculated today that McCain is just floating that idea so that when he picks someone like, oh, say, Mitt Romney, who only recently became anti-abortion, the McCain base will be relieved. Well, Democrats, too, are wrangling over abortion. The language in the party platform that will be voted on next week moves Democrats closer to the center, putting more focus on reducing the need for abortions. They've also given a speaking slot to Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, who opposes abortion rights. Polls show Americans don't like abortion, but don't want to see it outlawed in the early stages of pregnancy. And Dr. Susan Wicklund understands that, perhaps, conflict. We want to revisit our conversation with her. And this advice, it may not be for everyone, because she is brutally honest about her own abortion in 1976, 3 years after abortion was legalized, when she was young and didn't feel ready to be a mother. And honest as well about the abortions she now performs as a doctor. Her book is titled This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor. And I began by asking Susan Wicklund to take us back to 1976. Take us to the very beginning in your own procedure. You don't paint a very pleasant picture.
It wasn't. And I want to just preface by saying that I'm not sorry I had the abortion. It was a good choice. I'm very grateful that it was legal at that point. Unfortunately, I was in a clinic that did not pay a lot of attention to providing patients with a lot of information or really attending to their emotional needs. When I was scared, instead of explaining what was going on, I was basically told to shut up and lie still and eventually held down. And then because I fought, being held down, was given an injection and basically knocked out. That is not the norm today. I think about that procedure and what happened to me and how I felt about it with every single patient that I see now.
You could have left that room and said, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to telling other young women not to do this because it was a bad experience. Instead, you went in the other direction. Why?
I hadn't expected to be doing primarily abortions. I started out going to medical school because I loved doing births because of my own abortion, and I felt like doctors should do it better than what I'd had it done. I sought out and learned how to do abortions myself while I was in my internship. And when I went into a small practice in my hometown, expected to do abortions for my own patients, which is, I believe, how it should be done, and was told by the hospital board that I absolutely could not.
Because?
Well, because, of course, nobody in that community ever had had unwanted pregnancies, you know. You know, it was just this big blinders that go up, this total denial. So I started inquiring at some of the clinics within a couple hundred mile radius that provided abortions for women if they needed help. And the response was incredible. It turned out there was a huge need for physicians who were trained in doing abortions and that were willing to come to the clinics and provide that service.
I'm thinking of a point in your medical career where you were considering other aspects of medicine, and then you came across a woman who desperately asked you for a procedure and you didn't perform it. What happened?
Yeah. I was, you know, at the bottom of the chain of all the, you know, med students, interns. And she asked if I could please help her. She couldn't continue the pregnancy. She said that her man would kill it. It was a violent situation at home. She didn't have any money. The state did not pay for it. And I couldn't find anyone that would provide the procedure for free or for a reduced rate for her. Social services wasn't willing to plan on taking the baby away from the home until they saw a reason to. Mm-hmm. And she asked me about it many times throughout her pregnancy. I was not able to help her. In hindsight, I would have done things differently.
Well, because 1 week your pager goes off, you're called to the emergency room, and you go there to see what?
And she's holding a dead infant. She's given birth and gone home, and a short time later returns to the emergency room, and the baby is dead. And she said, basically said to me, this is your fault.
Now, you don't say that if the husband killed it, but that seems to be implied.
It's something I can't comment on.
Did you feel responsible for that?
I felt very responsible for not meeting the needs of a patient that asked me for help. I did come to realize it wasn't my fault that child was dead. It was largely my fault that the child was born.
You were also influenced later by a beloved grandmother?
Flower Grandma.
Yeah.
Well, been providing abortions for a couple of years by that point, actually almost 4 years, but I wasn't talking about it publicly. However, there'd been an incredible onslaught of protesters and violence directed towards myself and my family, both at the clinics and in our home. And there was going to be a special on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. My grandmother never missed 60 Minutes. So I went to tell my grandma about the 60 Minutes piece before she saw it, that I, you know, worked in women's reproductive health care. I was trying to approach it gently and see how where we were going to go with it. And she basically had me get up and come and sit down beside her by her rocking chair and proceeded to tell me the story of when she was a very young girl and her friend had gotten pregnant. My grandmother suspected it was incest but didn't know that for sure. The young woman knew that she couldn't continue the pregnancy. It was very taboo. And so Grandma and her sister were going to help the young woman end the pregnancy. She told me some details, but not a lot. Basically said they used something sharp and to start the bleeding, and they knew that would end the pregnancy. And the bottom line is that the young woman bled to death, that my grandma sat in the bed with this girl as she bled to death and was discovered by the father of the young girl, and they were, my grandma's sister and her were told they could never, ever speak of this to anyone. And Grandma sat and told me that story. She basically said to me she was glad that I was doing abortions safe so that women wouldn't die, so that women wouldn't be murdered by their best friends. And that's how she saw herself, as a murderer.
Yes. Well, you mentioned protesters. At this point, you say you're wearing a bulletproof vest, carrying a gun, commuting between clinics in different states wearing disguises. Because abortion doctors had been killed, you were receiving death threats, you had a stalker. Describe what was happening.
In Montana, at our home, we woke up one morning to people shouting, "Susan kills babies." We're living at the end of a 3-mile dead-end road out in the woods. The house was surrounded by people we didn't know, obviously. There was a banner across the driveway that said, "Susan kills babies." There was a bassinet on the doorstep with a doll in it spattered with red paint and fake money. People basically blocking the driveway. My daughter ended up having to ride to school in a police car a number of times. They went to her school. They followed me to and from the airport, tell other passengers they shouldn't get on the plane because there was a baby killer on board.
Your stalker, Michael Ross, was writing unbelievable letters to you, telling you how he was going to kill you. In your own county, no one would do anything, but then you wrote to another county where he was active, and their response was, "You're kidding me."
It was just chilling. We talked to the local police, and everyone just said, "Well, until he does something, we can't do anything about it." And then a clinic in Missoula, Montana, had a fire. And the next day, I received a letter from Michael Ross saying, "Gosh, see what happened in Missoula. I wonder if you're going to be next." So we sent all the letters that we had at that point over to the fire marshal in Missoula, and they apparently sent those letters to the county attorney in Missoula, who called me and said, "My God, this is outrageous. This is a felony crime. It's called felony intimidation. We're going to have him arrested and charged immediately." And they did, and there was a subsequent jury trial, which I had to testify and read some of these letters. He was found guilty of felony intimidation and served quite a number of years in federal prison.
Well, I was going to ask, you said served. Is he out?
He's out.
Do you still fear for your life? And if so, you know, and then writing the book, doesn't that make it, you know, more dangerous?
It does, but in the bigger picture, this is what has to happen.
We'll be back with Dr. Susan Wicklund in 1 minute here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with abortion provider Dr. Susan Wicklund. We're reprising it as the issue has been raised in the presidential race with speculation that John McCain might pick a pro-choice VP. Dr. Wicklund's book is This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor. She received an abortion as a young woman in Oregon and became a doctor and abortion provider and a target. I asked her why she continued to perform abortions even though protesters targeted not only her but her family.
The biggest reason I was able to continue working is because I had an incredibly supportive husband and an incredibly supportive daughter. I never said to her then, although in hindsight, I know that she understood, that she was the one person who could have gotten me to stop. And I think the protesters know that. They know that the weak link is often with the doctors' families, particularly their kids.
Well, let's talk about the procedure. You insisted on screening patients. You seemed very concerned about performing an abortion that you or the woman might regret. And you are brutally honest about the one you did, Mrs. P. who came into you.
Yeah.
You didn't know that she and her husband thought her pregnancy was the result of a rape. You performed the procedure and then found out what?
We found out that the embryo was not a result of the rape, and that was my fault. Every woman, I ask every single one, are you absolutely sure this is what you want to do? Is this your decision, or is somebody pushing you or forcing you to have this abortion? And if anyone hesitates in the least on answering that question, we stop.
You even in some cases seem to say to women, you know, I'm not sure you're a candidate here.
Absolutely. Sometimes the body language is screaming no when their voice is saying yes. I listen to the body language. I would much rather have a patient be extremely angry with me or even to the extent of taking legal action against me for not doing an abortion than for doing one.
But Mrs. P seemed clear. Afterwards, what happened?
First of all, when we were ready to start and I asked her those questions and she said she was sure, she said to me, I can't continue this pregnancy. That should have been my clue. I should have asked, is there a medical reason? Is there something else? And I didn't ask that. And then when I was done, I always look at the tissue, the products of conception that comes out of the uterus, came into the room and asked how she was doing. And she said she was so relieved that she could never have continued this pregnancy because of the rape. And when she said that, my heart just sunk. My legs went weak, and I sat down and kind of crumbled down into a chair because I knew that she was 2 weeks different. She had conceived 2 weeks before the rape.
With her husband?
Yeah, she'd conceived with her husband, which was devastating for all of us. All of us ended up having to deal with it with counseling later on. They were very forgiving. They knew that this was not information I'd had ahead of time. I have not done a single abortion since then without an ultrasound first. I will not make that mistake again.
But some would say, even that one mistake, that might be enough for someone to say, oopsie, that's the reason why we can't have this procedure at all.
That's absolutely ridiculous to think that we should outlaw or not allow abortions for any woman because of single things that may happen to an individual woman. Absolutely not.
You also tell the stories of women who write you and come to you thanking you.
The letters and calls and squeeze of the hand that I get from women after I've seen them is extremely helpful. Pictures of kids when women come into the clinic and we see that, again, their body language or some part of them is saying no and we send them away. I hold them very precious and I'm very grateful.
What about laws? For instance, a law that would mandate that a woman take time to think about her pregnancy, like a 24-hour waiting period. You seem to almost be kind of advocating that in the interviews that you do with women and the counseling. But what if it were law?
Well, it is law in many states, and that's a real barrier. My goodness sakes, look at places where you've got women who have to travel a big distance. And if they have to come to the clinic and have information that's state mandated, then leave and come back to the clinic at a later date twice, find time off work, find child care.
How about whether girls under 18 should be allowed to get an abortion without a parent's consent?
That's really hard. I mean, when you say, well, you know, don't you want minors to tell their parents? Well, of course you do. The reality is the huge majority of minors do talk to their parents about it. But there are a handful of situations. There are some women who can't, whether it's because of potential violence in the family. She needs to have an alternative, a court system, to get permission from a judge. But, of course, that's another barrier.
Do you have sympathy with people who really just, they have an uneasy feeling about abortions? Do you have sympathy with that?
Oh, of course. I have a lot of sympathy for people, even if they're out in front of the clinics and are just there being available if somebody does want to talk to them. There are many people who I've talked to over the years.
What was fascinating is the number of times you had women who were actively anti-choice who ended up in your office.
Yeah.
How did they rationalize that?
I just didn't know. I didn't realize what it would be like to actually have an unintended pregnancy. Many times it was for the very reasons they were condemning other women, whether it was economic reasons or career reasons, because it's their life. They've got breast cancer or cervical cancer. If they don't end this pregnancy, they may die. And when I talk to them and say, do you feel that the woman who lives next door to you, are her reasons any less than yours? And they're willing to look at it in a different way.
Well, Susan, you paint an incredible picture. And yet I'm wondering, is this history? You write of a physician with a clinic who was under assault and literally put an ad in the paper and said, where are you, all of you that we helped? Are you saying something to them as well? You know, maybe not to come out, but to support the people who were there for them.
Absolutely. One of the things that's hurting us in our quest to keep reproductive rights available to all women is that we don't talk about it.
And it seems that being able to talk about it will allow that woman who may have some emotional pain, even though she had a procedure that she very much felt, you know, she needed, she has no place to put that pain.
That's right. I think you put it very well. And I'm so hoping that this book will open the dialogue and make people understand that it isn't just politics, it isn't theory, it isn't just law, it's individual lives. Nothing is black and white. We make decisions at any given time in our lives based on the information we have at that moment. And that's what we have to remember.
Our conversation with Dr. Susan Wicklund from earlier this year. Her book is This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, a talk with Montana writer Rick Bass on decades of being an activist and just plain pain in the butt in an effort to save the wilderness he writes about. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, should museums give back the antiquities that belong to other countries? One prominent museum director says no, they belong to the world. After the news, Here and Now. On the NBC comedy The Office, one of the accountants, Kevin, has a love affair with a paper shredder.
This thing is so awesome. It will shred anything. Ooh. It will shred a CD. It will shred a credit card. It will shred... Oh.
Whoops, it did shred his credit card. And that's not just any shredder. You can plainly see it's a Staples shredder. And Staples paid to have it placed in the episode. And in case you miss a logo, other shows have started talking about their products. Here's the CW Network's Smallville touting the virtue of AccuView's disposable contact lenses.
I thought the glasses were fake.
Are you kidding? I'm blind as a bat.
Besides, the mask doesn't look so good with glasses over it. AccuView to the rescue.
That's nothing. The TV show The Biggest Loser had almost 4,000 product placements in just a couple of months. All in all, product placement has grown 33% since last year. The Federal Communications Commission is now considering regulating product placement on TV. A coalition of 23 advocacy groups has petitioned the FCC in favor of regulation. The Writers Guild of America is asking for an on-screen crawl to identify paid placement of a product in a scene. Adonis Hoffman is the senior vice president of the American Association of Advertising Agencies. Adonis, I'm guessing where you fall on this issue.
Certainly, we think that additional regulation is not necessary at this time.
Well, what kind of regulation is there, first of all? Tell us, what do advertisers have to do or programs have to do when they place a product?
Every commercial has to be identified in a television program or a radio program. And that usually happens at the beginning of the program or at the end of the program.
So in the credits or something, they might say such and such supplied by...
Yes, promotional consideration provided by whatever the company is.
Well, you know what critics say, that hardly anybody reads the credits. And it's that moment when something comes up on the screen, whether it's Coca-Cola or popcorn or we're reading articles about how Cisco Systems embeds some of its telepresence conference call devices in programs, mm-hmm. that it's that moment when, you know, either subliminally or just, you know, understanding, you are watching a commercial within a program.
Well, that's an interesting point, Robin. I'll take the view that the Federal Trade Commission has adopted, and that is if a product appears in a program and it's not making a claim, that is, AccuView's not better than its competitor, or AccuView can provide you with, you know, wonderful vision from here on out. Hmm. If it's not making any kind of claim like that, then there's no additional independent disclaimer or notice required.
This was when the Federal Trade Commission considered this issue in 2005 and shot down the idea of more regulations on product placement. But you know what people say. The coalition of groups that has petitioned the FCC says this is hijacking programming. It makes a mockery of TV ad limits. It sort of end runs, you know, the advertising limits. It threatens public health because it puts things in front of people, products in front of people. I go back to Coca-Cola, let's say, mm-hmm. for a program that kids might watch that parents might want to keep kids away from in that case. You know, what do you think about that? That it's sort of an ambush.
Well, in fact, there are very clear rules affecting children's programming. But I think that their focus is on programs that are not children's programming, but who happen to attract 30% or more kids.
Sure.
Think of American Idol or some other program where kids, like my own teenagers, tend to watch. Those are not children's programming by definition.
And Simon Cowell sits there with his cola in front of him as he judges the contestants on American Idol. As you said, non-cable children's programming can't contain any product placement. You, I'm sure, know that studies show that children under the age of 8 can't even distinguish between real television commercials and content, so they certainly can't distinguish between products that are placed and content. What's wrong with putting some sort of a crawl, as the Writers Guild is calling for, on the screen when a product comes up saying this is a product placement?
Well, I think a crawl would be exceptionally distracting. I think they've also called for a pop-up in normal programming. So you've got pop-up every time a product appears. The question becomes, Robin, where does that stop? There are enough programs where promotional consideration is provided for by companies. And, you know, when is disclosure enough?
But what about the creative aspect? I mean, disclosure is one thing. Do you think that advertisers have the right to go in and actually oversee how these products are written into programs? Because we understand these are the deals that are being struck, that advertisers are standing right on the set and they are writing these storylines.
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, function of the marketplace, and I, honestly speaking, I'm not getting into that. I think it's a dicey area, and it's to be left between the writers and the producers of the show and sort of how they work out their economics and their creative plan for the show. I do think, though, with respect to the pop-ups and the crawl, one listener, I was on a show not long ago, and we were talking about this very same issue. Call-in person from, I think, Iowa said, listen, you know, we have enough spam on our computer sets when we go online. This kind of requirement where instant disclosure, pop-up or crawl, he likened it to spam on TV. Eventually, viewers will migrate away from free over-the-air broadcast television to cable where these requirements are not in the law.
On the other hand, there are some shows that have figured out a way to maybe have some more creativity when product placement is asked of them. Let's listen to a clip from 30 Rock. This is where the actors speak specifically to the product that's been placed in their script.
These Verizon wireless phones are just so popular, I accidentally grabbed one belonging to an acquaintance.
Well, sure, because that Verizon wireless service is just unbeatable. I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
But the problem, Adonis Hoffman, is you can only do that so many times. You know, you can only have that kind of fun so many times, and maybe only on 30 Rock. I mean, let's talk about the creativity. Do you think that advertisers have the right? And again, show executives are giving them this right, as you mentioned. It's the marketplace is driving this, but to interfere with the creative process.
There are some studies out there that suggest that consumers are really unaware of a vast majority of the product placements that occur. They seem to look at it as background or set material or just kind of, you know, gray matter out there and don't really think of it as a commercial or don't pay attention to the fact that the Dell computer that's on the desk was bought and paid for. It's just a computer.
Well, is this one of the problems, though? You mentioned that viewers are migrating away from television and they have so many other choices. Are advertisers simply trying to find a way to stay ahead of the viewers because you can have a TiVo, you can get rid of commercials, you can fast forward, you can choose to watch it through another method, you know, instead of watching The Office on television, go rent the season. Is this part of why advertisers are doing this?
Yes, they are. Viewing on television, network television and broadcast television have trended downward over the last several years and the technology that's available to skip commercials altogether, but also online and mobile, out-of-home media. Advertisers want to be able to capture viewers where they are, and they want to have their messages seen and remembered.
Adonis Hoffman, Senior Vice President of the American Association of Advertising Agencies. You can find out more about this at our website, here-now.org. Adonis, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
Okay, just going to make a little note here with my paper mate. No, you'll never hear that here. You're listening to Here and Now. Cardinal score one victory for the Hackers. Boston's metro system, here in Boston we call it the MBTA or the T, yesterday lost its bid in federal court to keep three MIT students quiet about how to hack into the agency's fare card system. We told you about these students last week. At that time, they were under a temporary gag order that prevented them from presenting their research at a hackers' convention. The students found ways to clone the magnetic strips on the T's fare tickets, known as Charlie tickets, in theory allowing people to ride the T for free. Well, here now is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff reports on the case.
Anatomy of a Subway Hack. It sounds like a thriller novel, but it's the title of a paper three MIT undergraduates planned to present earlier this month to the DEF CON conference of hackers. And now it's all over the internet, explaining how to clone subway tickets on the MBTA. The battle over this information was in federal court again yesterday, when the T asked a judge to extend the gag order on the students for 5 months while it fixes the problems. The agency admitted the students got it right and know how to counterfeit the Charlie tickets. Their research on copying the computer chips on Charlie cards hasn't been proven to work by the MBTA. But a judge ruled the students weren't violating federal law with the information and lifted the gag order. Cindy Cohen of the California-based Electronic Frontier Foundation represented the students who are away on summer break.
The First Amendment won today because it fully says that if you engage in security research and you're speaking truthful information, you get to speak it. It's improper for someone to go to court and try to gag you, that the federal law doesn't allow that.
But Cohen says the students don't want to tell everyone how to clone Charlie tickets. She says their presentation made it onto the internet because the MBTA filed it with court documents.
The MIT students never provided the information that would allow someone to do the free ride. To the extent that that information got out, MBTA filed it in the public record here. So to the extent that somebody figured out how to do this, I think the MBTA has to look at itself. You know, why are you providing this confidential information to the public instead of really trying to address it?
The lawyer for the T refused to comment after the hearing. In court, he said the T fears the students would give step-by-step instructions on how to hack the system. In a statement, MBTA General Manager Dan Grabauskas says that now that the court proceedings are done, he invites the students to sit down with them and discuss their findings. Earlier this month, the three students gave a confidential security analysis to the MBTA so it could fix the gaps and told them they wanted to present some of what they found at a national conference. A T security officer gave them the green light, but days later, the MBTA filed suit, arguing that distributing the information violates the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Yesterday, the judge ruled the CFAA, as it's called, is aimed at people who create viruses or worms to attack computer systems. He agreed with the student's lawyer that publishing their information or sharing it with an audience is not the same as transmitting a virus through a computer to compromise a system. The ruling is a good thing for the large research community in the Boston area, says John Reinstein, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts.
If the statute had been interpreted in the way that the MBTA was arguing, I think we correctly argue that it would cast a substantial pall on research activities.
The student's presentation also notes that you don't need a degree in computer science to ride the T for free. Entryways are often unguarded, doors are unlocked, and turnstile control boxes are open in many stations.
That's Here and Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Well, as Monica said, the students were not at the hearing yesterday, but we spoke last week with Jack Anderson. He told us he and his teammates were surprised by the lawsuit since an MBTA official initially gave them the okay to present their paper at the Hackers Convention. He said the whole case has been a huge learning experience.
I learned quite a bit. I think I learned a lot about the law, number one, a lot about handling a small situation that overnight turns into a huge fiasco. And I think, I guess, perhaps there had to have been some sort of miscommunication here for something like this to happen. You know, when we had, you know, reassurances saying everything was fine, and apparently that wasn't the case.
Well, now the MBTA says it will take 5 months to fix the security gaps the students revealed, and they're going to have to fix them with the gag order removed. Zach and his team's work is online. You can see it at our website, here-now.org. And by the way, the students got an A on their initial paper for MIT. So from a debate on who owns security information to a debate about who owns all those antiquities and museums around the world, we'll have that in 1 minute here and now.
So Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Who owns antiquity? It's a volatile issue as museums come under increasing pressure to return art objects to the countries where they were found. Greece has long sought the return of the marble statues taken from the Parthenon by Britain's Lord Elgin. And while Greece waits, last year Peru got Yale University to agree to return a trove of precious objects dug up and brought to Yale almost 100 years ago by a charismatic professor and explorer who was a model for the character of Indiana Jones. Well, our next guest, James Cuno, takes issue with the idea that art objects belong to the nation state where they are found. He says they belong to humanity, and he argues that while the return of objects may be a victory for nations, it's a defeat for humanity. Cuno is president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago and former director of the Harvard University Art Museums. His new book is Who Owns Antiquity? Museums and the Battle Over Ancient Heritage. James Cuno, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And, you know, you come at this topic at a maybe difficult time for you because, you know, everything in our culture is saying, bring it back. I'm thinking of Indiana Jones in the latest movie, Return the Crystal Skull, you know, to where it was found. That's sort of the thinking that's promulgated by popular culture, isn't it?
Well, it is, I think, and it's promoted as well by some of our most august international organizations. And UNESCO, for example, has been organizing a number of international conferences promoting the return of cultural property to its countries of origin. And that's based on the presumption that these objects have particular meaning to some particular people and ought to be with those particular people independent of how they might have been acquired or the meaning they have in the context in which they're currently seen.
Well, let's give an example. You write you happened to be in Rome when an ancient bowl was returned to Italy by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. First of all, tell us about the bowl, the Euphronius crater. Have I said that correctly?
Yes, that's correct, the Euphronius crater. It's an ancient Greek pot that was made by a Greek potter named Eusithius and the Greek painter Euphronius. It's signed by Euphronius. And it was made for the robust commerce between Greece and Etruria, which is an ancient culture in the northern part of the peninsula that is now today Italy.
Well, see, there it is. You've just described something that's Greek, and yet it was returned to Italy.
It's an interesting point that you make, and not only with this pot do we see evidence in which Greek culture was profoundly present on the peninsula that is now Italy, before the rise of Rome, and then even after the rise of Rome.
Well, but don't the Italians have a point that it's the land they live on now? So it's sort of, you know, a birthright in that it's of their land. Wouldn't Americans also feel the same way about, Indian artifacts that were kept in another museum overseas, or parts of the U.S. that were French, for instance, you know, before the Revolution? Wouldn't, if things were taken from the land, isn't that a point?
I'm not arguing that these things that are found within the jurisdiction of the modern nation state shouldn't also be identified with that modern nation state in some way. I think not quite in that long racial, ethnic, cultural way that some modern nations want that identity to be shaped or formed, but rather I'm arguing for the sharing, the broadening of this as something that would promote understanding around the world.
In fact, you call these laws that nations have to keep their cultural property within the boundaries of their country. You call these, you know, nationalist, retentionist cultural property laws. That's what they do. They retain their things. And you say these laws work against the ideals of the encyclopedic museum. Yours is one, the Art Institute of Chicago. What's an encyclopedic museum? And why is that more of a problem for those museums when things are retained?
Well, the encyclopedic museum, the origins of it lie in the Enlightenment. It's the idea of the museum as a repository of things dedicated to the dissemination of learning and to the museum's role as a force for understanding and tolerance. It is the idea that under one roof one can have representative examples of the world's diverse artistic cultures for the benefit of promoting understanding of culture as always hybrid, as always mongrel, as always bearing the imprint of contact with new and strange and wonderful things. It's the idea that we can learn more about the multiple narratives of our human ancestors on this planet by bringing them into contact with each other, and we can in the process promote greater understanding of the current conditions within which we live on this planet.
Well, an obvious point is that if you have all of these things juxtaposed under one roof, someone can see them, whereas if they were all in separate countries, you'd have to either live there or travel there to see them. But it seems as if there has to be a little quid pro quo here, because you write that these encyclopedic museums are a good idea, which means they're a good idea everywhere, which means that, you know, museums like yours have to share.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's just exactly the point. What must be adjusted, it seems to me, is not the principle of the encyclopedic museum, but the balance of power and economic forces in the world. And we know that that's happening. It's going to be a different world 100 years from now, and we can take advantage of this realignment to promote this idea of understanding.
But James Cuno, isn't this an easier theory to hold as a Westerner? You know, for countries that have been plundered, that have seen things that, for instance, were religious items end up in museums as artifacts, isn't it harder for them to accept this, let's all share this material, than it is for someone in a Western museum?
Well, I'm not sure why that should be the case.
Because they were the plundered, and most Western museums have been the archaeologists or the colonizers or the imperialists. You know.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't make the easy equation between archaeologists and imperialists, or between.
Well, I'm differentiating. I'm saying those are different ways that items got into Western museums.
Where they have been, of course, preserved and studied and presented to the world that is increasingly mobile right now, in which there are some millions of people living outside the country of their birth currently in this age of new globalization. That said, I'm sure it is easier for me to say so. It doesn't mean that it's wrong for me to say so, mm-hmm. but it might be easier for me to say so and to make the case. We also know that those people all value access to current products of manufacture produced globally, whether they be automobiles, iPhones, radios, whatever they might be. And we ought to find a way to share our ancient past equally.
Well, you make another point that not all peoples live in their homelands and don't get to see artifacts because in some places they're politicized, aren't they? I mean, this gives an opportunity for some people who have been shut out of their homeland to see things from their homeland.
We can certainly see that throughout the world, that there are people who have sought refuge and new beginnings in new places who deserve to have access not just to the new things, but the old things, which they might identify as, for example, Nigerians living in Chicago. But that could be said also of Chinese or Indians living in Africa, living in Australia. It is a fact that since we left East Africa some 60,000 years ago, we have sought new opportunities, and with new opportunities, we have come across new and strange and wonderful things and have made culture as a result of it.
James Cuno is president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, former director of the Harvard University Art Museums. His new book is Who Owns Antiquity, Museums, and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage, and he's written several articles, including one that I'm looking at in a Yale publication, Who Owns the Past? Antiquities from Great Cultures Belong to Humanity, Not Nation States That Emerged Centuries Later. Jim Cuno, one last question for you. Philippe de Montebello, the head of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is said to be leaving soon at the end of the year, and there's much speculation on the internet that you might be a candidate to move to that prestigious museum. Your thoughts on that?
I remain committed to the Art Institute of Chicago and to its place in the life of this great city.
Oh, come on. Can't we be the first to know whether or not you're going to New York?
That's the true story.
Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Robin.